I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest today is Julian Langness. Julian, welcome to the show.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
It's great to have you on. I've known Julian for several years now. He is the author of a book called Fistfights with Muslims in Europe. He has a new book coming out entitled Identity Rising. He spoke at the very first Northwest Forum in Seattle back in 2016, and he spoke last year at the American Renaissance Conference in Tennessee. And I think he's going to have a long, illustrious career as a nationalist writer and commentator. And so it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And just to begin, you have a really interesting intellectual journey from Obama delegate and Obama supporter to advocate for white people. So can you sketch that out just briefly?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is an interesting journey, and I write about it in the new book, Identity Rising. But basically, I grew up in a really small rural Republican town, but my parents were both liberal PhD anthropologists from UCLA. So while I was growing up and I was a teenager, I had kind of pretty disparate views, and I was pretty conservative in some ways. You know, I was very pro-gun, stuff like that. Grew up in a really blue-collar community, you know, hunted, that sort of thing. So I appreciated a lot of things from a conservative angle, but I also kind of had that liberal influence, and even more than from my parents, I'd say, just from public education and from the entertainment industry, you know, like most people in my generation, like most people today. But then during college, I sort of, I attended the University of Washington, and I sort of started moving in a more liberal, degenerate direction, and they weren't really, really good years in my life. I was pretty much just partying and using a lot of drugs and focusing way more on my rights than on my responsibilities, as Jordan Peterson would say. And during that time, I also became a big political junkie. And when the 2008 election season rolled in, I had three candidates I really liked. And this is going to sound kind of ridiculous and contradictory, but I really liked Ron Paul, Barack Obama, and Tom Tancredo. And I liked Tancredo because at that time I had already traveled to Europe, like I talk about in my first book, and I was already aware of the insanity of mass immigration and everything that was going on there just a little bit. It was just starting to kind of germinate in my mind. But then I liked Ron Paul and Obama because of the fact that I was, you know, focused so much on these kind of libertine, libertarian issues and maximizing freedom and rights and drug legalization and, you know, legalized prostitution and legalized everything, all the whole libertine libertarian spiel, basically. But I ended up volunteering for the Obama campaign, and that was partly random, but partly because the state I was in, the Democratic caucuses took place way before the Republican primary. So it just kind of happened semi-randomly. But I mean, I definitely was a big Obama supporter at that time, even though my brain was sort of, there was this dichotomy in my brain where I was already appreciative of some more conservative right-wing issues, and I was already starting to be alarmed at mass immigration, at least in Europe. But for whatever reason, the sort of libertine, left-wing liberal things overruled that in my mind, and I ended up volunteering for Obama, went to the state convention, and then I got elected to go to the national convention in Denver as part of our state delegation, and I was one of the youngest Obama delegates in the whole country. And it's actually quite ridiculous and kind of interesting, but I remember at the convention, you know, all of us young millennial Obama supporters, that was the big cliche, is these young Obama supporters, and we all were getting interviewed by lots of journalists. And I remember getting interviewed by different European journalists and telling them how much I loved Pim Fortuyn and Geert Wilders, and I'm sure they just thought I was absolutely insane, because here I am, this young Obama delegate, but I'm talking about how much I like these really right-wing populist politicians in Europe. And that definitely foreshadowed the switch in my thinking, because within about 6 months after the convention, within a year, I had pretty much completely done a 180 and was already quite ashamed of having supported Obama and already pretty horrified about it. And more than anything, one of the big kind of epiphanies that led to that was meeting a lot of these sort of older baby boomer liberal white Obama supporters at the convention, and they were just in kind of emotional hysterics the whole time and crying and just over the top of themselves with this idea that they were supporting this, you know, the first black president, yada yada yada. And it was really a massive turnoff, and the combination of being exposed to them and I guess what I'd call their sort of over emotionality or virtue signaling, combined with my experiences at that time in Europe traveling around and seeing the results of liberalism over there and of mass immigration, was really what catalyzed that kind of swift turnabout in a more right-wing direction. And then from there, it sort of evolved over a number of years, probably 4 or 5 years, until I ultimately became acquainted with your excellent site, Countercurrents and Traditional Right, and other sites in that vein, where I finally kind of felt like I found an intellectual home.
That's a great story, and it's not an unusual story. I think that there are a lot of people who are making the same kind of intellectual journey, and I think it's really valuable for you to talk about that kind of stuff, even though to some people that seems very unusual. I think a lot of people out there can relate to it, and it's important for us to just put our narratives out there, put our intellectual journeys out there, to talk about how we came to be who we are, why we write, and so forth, because people can identify with that on a personal level. And that kind of personal identification, I think, makes it easier for people to entertain fairly radical ideas that might seem kind of forbidding if they didn't come wrapped in a very human narrative that they can identify with.
Well, I will confess, I've never been a member of the Democratic Party, and I've never been as active as you were, but I actually did vote for Bill Clinton both times in the 90s. So I'll just put that out there. In
my defense, you're fired. Though, you're fired, John. That's the final straw.
I have to say, though, I mean, between Bush the First and Bob Dole, I mean, they had absolutely nothing to offer, you know, from our perspective. So I really don't have any regrets on that. I didn't do it because I thought Bill Clinton was any kind of, you know, great man or messiah or anything, but I just thought, you know, Dole and Bush were so pathetic.
Right. Yeah.
If Buchanan had run, I probably would have.
Right.
Know. Well, he did, actually. Or did he? He didn't run on the Republican, though, in the 90s, did he?
He ran in the Republican primaries, but he never got the nomination, if I remember right.
Yeah,
right.
He ran in the Reform Party in 2000.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I would have, by then, I definitely would have voted for him. I was on my way to being red-pilled by then, so.
Right. Yeah. Well, we have to understand that before people become red-pilled, they were always something else. And it's the easiest game in the world to play to rewind the tape or look at somebody's curriculum vitae back to the point where they were something else and then say, this person doesn't seem to be legit. Look, before, he wasn't always a white advocate. Therefore, there must be something wrong with him, as if, you know, any of us are born that way. But I thought that was funny. People did that with Jason Kessler. So, well, Jason Kessler can't be legit.
Yeah.
Look, he believed other things in the past. It's like that is a sword with a double edge. We can't afford to wield that. And honestly, if we're just open about the various strange intellectual journeys that people have taken, I think, like I said, it really helps people identify with us and helps people come on board. So let's talk a little bit, Julian, about your first book, and then we'll talk about two new projects, the forthcoming new book, Identity Rising, which we've published an excerpt from at Countercurrents this past week, and also your YouTube channel, which I think is very promising. So tell us a little bit about Fistfights with Muslims in Europe. Did you win?
Sounds good. Yeah, so Fistfights with Muslims in Europe was my first book, and I published it right about 2 years ago. I think probably about 6 months after I started writing for you and at some other sites. And it basically describes my journeys in Europe. I can't remember exactly how old I was. I went there several times in my late teens. I think the youngest I was either 16 or 17. I convinced my parents to buy me a plane ticket over there and basically just wandered around for the summer, doing all sorts of idiotic things and having adventures. And then I returned to Europe, I think, two other times during college. So it sort of describes that. And basically, as I've described it before, in real life, I was kind of undergoing, I'd say, two parallel awakenings or journeys at that point. And the first one was this sort of, I guess you could call, masculine awakening, where, like most people in the millennial generation, I'd been raised with all this indoctrination about toxic masculinity and all this stuff like that. And I think that, like a lot of people in my generation, I wasn't doing particularly well as a teenager in college. I was really confused and engaging in a lot of very self-destructive behaviors that were probably subconscious replacements for what would have been the sort of masculine coming-of-age ceremonies or experiences that people had in the past throughout 99% of human history. And part of that was, you know, drinking, doing drugs, you know, doing, you know, backflips off of cliffs into lakes, all the stupid things that teenagers do. But then part of it, too, was just kind of getting in these random fist fights at parties or wherever, and they weren't particularly noble or impressive or anything like that. I mean, it's just mostly drunken idiocy, and, you know, some of them took place when I was in college in the U.S., and then a couple took place in Europe with, you know, people of Muslim background when I was being a drunken idiot over there. So that was sort of the one journey, and then at the same time, I was sort of undergoing this journey of, you know, cultural or racial awakening, where I was kind of starting to really have pride in my ancestry and heritage, and becoming aware of the existential threats facing our people and facing Europe and everything like that. So the book sort of, you know, in a slightly more purposeful way describes those. You know, in real life, I, you know, at that age, I didn't have the understanding of it all I do now. So I kind of take my understanding that I have now, and then kind of describe it along with the narrative of my experiences when I was younger. So it's a little bit different than how it actually took place. I say it's a little cleaner and the narrative is a little more simple. You know, in real life, there was way more confusion and frustration and idiocy and everything like that. But it's basically an attempt to describe, you know, my own journey of that political metamorphosis or awakening, and sort of masculine metamorphosis or awakening, which in many respects was catalyzed by my trips to Europe that had a huge impact on me when I was a teenager and young, early 20-something.
That's great. And you came out and gave in 2016 a talk for the Northwest Forum, and I believe you told me that was the first time you had ever spoken publicly. I thought you gave a great talk. I think it's online. I know I recorded it and sent a copy of it to Jared Taylor. And then in 2017, you spoke at AMREN. Do you want to talk a little bit about that experience? And then we'll segue sure. into the new project.
Sure, that would be great. Yeah, those were both absolutely incredible experiences. I'm immensely grateful for both of them. And that was the first time I'd ever really given a public speech. I mean, I had a little bit of experience in that sort of thing. I used to be the regional program director of a mental health provider. I had 37 people under me, so I'd have to talk at like team meetings and stuff like that. But I had never actually gotten up in front of an audience and ever spoken before that Northwest Forum. So that was an extremely cool, you know, frightening at the time, anxiety producing, but amazing experience. And I'm very grateful that you gave me the opportunity to do that. And then the same with AMREN. I was, of course, delighted to be invited to speak there. And I very much appreciate you sending that tape to Jared and kind of putting that in motion. But yeah, it was an absolutely fantastic experience. It was amazing getting to go to Tennessee. I mean, it's an incredible area that it takes place in. It's just the drive there from the airport and staying at that hotel / national park or whatever it is pretty amazing. But then also just meeting all the other people in attendance. And I've talked about this before, but, I do think that, as you've talked about, you know, to a small extent, I think our movement does attract some bad apples. I think in any kind of vanguardist controversial movement is going to do that. However, on the whole, all the people I've met at the Northwest Forums and at AMREN or any similar places are the most high quality people I've met my entire life. I mean, it really is incredible. So it was an amazing experience getting to meet and kind of rub shoulders, with so many, you know, impressive people. Who are really sacrificing a lot. I mean, in a multitude of different ways, in varying ways, but really sacrificing a lot for this movement of ours and, you know, trying to combat the threats that are facing us, particularly in Europe, but also here in America. And then getting to speak at it was amazing too. And my speech at AMREN, I'd say pretty much matches or parallels the focus of the new book in terms of, I guess we'll get into that in a minute, but the baby boomers, millennials, the future, everything like that. But yeah, absolutely incredible experiences.
Yeah, you were the keynote speaker, which was really very cool. I like that. I'm glad that Jared put you up there. He's always looking for new talent, and he's always looking for people who are younger and can relate to the up-and-coming young generation. I was just talking to Millennial Woes today, and we mentioned the National Alliance, and I was chatting with somebody the other day who's very much into our scene, and he had never heard of the National Alliance or William Pierce. And then I realized that William Pierce died when this guy was 10 years old. And that was 16 years ago. That's more than half the lifetimes of a lot of the people who are getting involved in the cause today. They're coming at this from a very different background, a very new background, and it's important to find people who are younger and who can relate to this up-and-coming audience. They don't have a lot of the history / baggage of the older generation, and I think it's important. I have been saying for years, sort of half jokingly, I guess you'd call it a meme, that the greatest generation will be the millennials, because the millennials are going to be the ones who turn this whole thing around. They're going to have to turn history around. And of course, the Gen Z people coming up behind them are going to be part of that too. So I love the title of your new book. And I remember you outlined that at Amran. So what's the title of the new book, the full title? And tell us a little bit about its genesis and its message.
Sure. So first of all, the title is Identity Rising, How Nationalist Millennials Will Retake Europe, Save America, and Become the New Greatest Generation. And it's a, you know, kind of 20% tongue-in-cheek, but 80% serious and sort of, you know, a little bit intentionally provocative, but it is serious and sincere too. And I'll tell you the exact moment of genesis for the book, which is also kind of the focus of the second prologue. The first prologue is describing the Brandenburg Gate protest that Generation Identitaire did, but the second prologue describes the genesis of the book, or what was the genesis, where it was probably about a year and a half ago, and I was listening to a podcast that Brett McKay at artofmanliness.com did with Neil Howe, who is one of the co-authors of all those generations books, the Strauss-Howe generation theory. You guys are probably all familiar with it. But I've always loved artofmanliness.com. It's a fantastic site. It's not political at all, but I'd say implicitly it's very political and kind of controversial in that it's trying to frame masculinity and kind of old-fashioned manliness in a very positive way. But anyway, he was interviewing Howe, one of the co-authors of these generation books. And these guys, Howe and Strauss, I think the first book came out in the 80s where they introduced their whole generations theory, that it's kind of these repeating cycles of different kinds of generations. And then they actually wrote a book in the 90s called Millennials Rising, which predicted exactly what you just said, that that millennials will be the new greatest generation. And that's basically entailed in their theory is that millennials are basically the fourth generation after the greatest generation, and that in their theory, the generations repeat in like a, you know, four layers, you know, a four-part cycle. So within their theory, millennials are the new greatest generation, which they call that secular permutation, the hero generation. So they had written a book in the 90s predicting that millennials would be the new greatest generation. So when Brett McKay was interviewing Howe, like last year, year and a half ago, this is exactly what he asked him. He said, okay, you wrote this book in the 90s and it's been, you know, 15, 20 years since then. How do you see millennials now ending up being the greatest generation? What is it they're going to do that's going to, you know, achieve this greatness? And Howe was just utterly at a loss for words. He didn't have anything to say at all. It was really funny, actually. It, you know, just completely dumbstruck. It was clear he had no idea how millennials might actually do this. And McKay was sort of trying to throw him some bones. He's like, well, I don't know, maybe millennials will like do interesting things with technology. But they just, neither of them had any solid thing they could advance for why millennials would be a great generation. But for me, listening to it in my car, I was like screaming into my headset, you know, that, because it was obvious to me, is that if millennials end up being, you know, a great generation, it's going to come through basically saving the West from all the insanity and suicide that the baby boomer generation and progressivism has put us on a trajectory for. And I think there's, you know, obviously examples of this, Generation Identitaire in Europe and, you know, similar groups here in America. And obviously that those groups don't really account for the popular perception of the millennial generation yet. I think when most people think of millennials, they think of, you know, blue-haired social justice warriors, you know, whining about X, Y, and Z. And that's probably fair to some extent because we certainly have no shortage of those. However, that's nothing new. I mean, that's just a kind of pale, sad reflection of baby boomer liberalism and the, you know, progressive orthodoxy that's controlled society for the last 40 years now and controls, you know, every powerful institution that exists, the universities, the media, the entertainment industry, everything. So I think the only real role that I could see millennials having, and that which I certainly hope that our generation has, is as a response that sort of overturns that and turns us in the exact opposite direction and keeps Europe from becoming destroyed or Islamized, Western Europe, that is, keeps America from descending into being Brazil. And I think that's what I could see our generation doing that would be worthy of that kind of moniker. And that's the hopeful, well, one of the scenarios that is advanced in my book, and obviously the most hopeful one and the one that I hope comes to fruition.
That's really well said. Mike, John, do you have any thoughts or questions about this so far?
We of course all hope that this is what's going to transpire, is that the younger generations will step up. I think the important thing isn't getting people enthusiastic about this, because right now we've got a lot of young people who are getting interested in this thing. My hope is that we have to find a way to keep people involved, because I think a lot of people, when they get into this stuff, you know, they think at first that, oh, this is really great and exciting, and they really think that, you know, change is just around the corner, because, you know, they're just getting involved with it. But those of us who've been around for a while know, I mean, it's going to take a lot of work over a long period of time, that there will be victories but also setbacks that you have to be able to absorb and deal with. So my hope is that we have to find a way to keep people involved, or even if, you know, they go on, you know, they're not full-time activists, but they go on to other careers and whatever, that they still remain engaged with the sort of worldview that we advocate for, and that they remain engaged in the struggle, we could say, the cultural and political struggle. You know, right now, I mean, what I've seen before what we could call white nationalism 2.0 or whatever that's arisen in recent years, I saw a lot of people who came and went before that, and I think the problem for many of them was that they realized that once they got families and they got careers going and all these things, that they both, you know, were a lot busier. And also, of course, it's not to your advantage to be involved in those things, because, you know, it makes you a pariah, basically, as far as your community and workplace and so forth. And a lot of people don't really want to make that plunge, and I don't really blame them. I mean, I've been very lucky in that I've been able to do this full time. But most people, you know, they have to think about how to live their lives. So my hope is that with the new generation of people who's just become active in recent years, like yourself, that we can find a way to keep them engaged and not to get sort of discouraged by the fact that, you know, let's face it, the Overton window has shifted in our favor, definitely. But it's still, I mean, look at the number of people who've been involved in this stuff in the alt-right the last couple of years, have been doxxed and then lost their jobs or had problems at universities or whatever. How do we prepare people to deal with that, to continue to be engaged in our milieu without getting frustrated and thinking, I can't do this because it's going to become a problem in my life, for people who can't necessarily do this full time like some of us do?
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's a fantastic question.
Julian, I mean, you are a husband and a father. You've got a business, a job. You seem to have a pretty good, well-balanced life and also include the movement in it. So what is your advice to younger people coming up on how to balance all that?
Fantastic question. And the first part about, you know, how can this be achieved? That's something I talk about in the new book as well. But to answer more specifically your phrasing of the question, I guess to answer the question in general, I think, first of all, the foundation of it has to be what you always say very well, which is that a precondition of all of this has to be that each person chooses his own involvement, right? And what that looks like, and, you know, respecting the fact that everybody's situation is different and people are going to be able to involve themselves in varying amounts and varying ways. So I think that's the foundation of it all. But I think, you know, that's something, all the questions that you were just asking is stuff that often rolls through my mind. And I'm a real self-improvement junkie. Like, I am obsessed with all kinds of self-improvement stuff. I lift weights. I run. I'm into, you know, real estate investing, making money online, like anything self-improvement related, whether, you know, in terms of health or finance or anything else, I'm just an absolute nut for. And I used to kind of keep that in my brain, in one section of my brain, and then the politics or, you know, Europe, our people, the existential threats in another. And the same with my writing. You know, when I wrote about politics online, it was strictly political. And then, you know, I do some kind of usually anonymous writing about self-improvement and stuff like that, but I just kept it separate. But increasingly, at least for myself, but I would think with most people, what I've come to realize is that there isn't any difference between them. You know, the reason that I lift weights and try to be as strong as I can is the same reason that I try to fight for Europe not to be Islamized, you know, and the reason I read books about how to, you know, be a good father or a good husband is the same reason that I write for Countercurrents about all this stuff. I mean, it's all really the same. And I mean, you know, you could certainly just focus on self-improvement and just kind of ignore all the political and cultural things that are going on, and there's certainly no shortage of people who do that, but to me, they're one and the same. And then I think from there, it just becomes a question that each of us kind of have to ask ourselves individually is, you know, what is the best course for us? First of all, what is the best way that we can contribute to everything and fight back? And that's going to differ for differing people. You know, for one person, it might be being a total vanguardist and, you know, writing pretty controversial essays in their own name and kind of taking a lot of heat, but kind of pulling the Overton window rightward from outside of it. For another person, it might be being very much kind of inside the Overton window and very accessible to normies and very kind of respectable, but kind of pushing outward from inside of it and sort of, you know, attracting people who don't really realize that it's, that you're saying anything that controversial, and then just sort of implicitly or sort of carefully raising their awareness of these issues. And there's people who that do that really well too. And I don't think there's any one course. I think it all depends on the individual, and it's going to depend on the circumstances. I mean, if you're a independently wealthy bachelor, you know, you're going to be able to do way more stuff and be way more, not reckless, but way more of a vanguardist compared to if you're someone with, you know, who makes $60,000 a year at a corporate job and you have a stay-at-home wife and four kids. So in my case, you know, I'm trying to walk that line, and I try to not put anything online that I wouldn't be comfortable defending to someone in real life who I, you know personally or through business or anything like that. I'm try to be extremely, extremely, extremely careful with how I, you know, label myself and my beliefs and everything like that. But for me, the self-improvement side and the political side are basically one and the same.
Yeah, that's well said. I think what we have to do is actually take a page from the communists in this case. There's a book that I read years ago. It was recommended to me by Gregory Hood, actually. It's called Dedication and Leadership, and it was written by a former communist who later became a Catholic, and it was his advice to activists based on his experience with communism. And one of the things that he said that I thought was extremely valuable and seemed kind of unlikely given the behavior of communists throughout the world is that they emphasized that if you wanted to be an activist in their movement, you had to be an all-around good person. They weren't going to accept people who were fanatical communists, but, you know, beat their wives and didn't, you know, were bad employees, who didn't take care of their children, who didn't keep their promises in other areas of their lives. And I thought that was really a valuable piece of advice for two reasons. One, because, of course, part of persuasion is not what you say, but what you do. And if you're an exemplary person in all spheres of your life, that is going to lend some credibility to your political views. And the other reason why it's a valuable lesson is because it prevents you from burning out. There are lots of people who will claim, well, I can slack off in this area or that area if I'm just really, really dedicated to the one thing that's needful, the one important thing in life. But if you do that all the time, and if you don't have other parts of your life that you give some attention to and also cultivate, what that'll lead you to do is burn out. And so you might burn very, very bright, but you'll burn out very, very fast. And in the end, you're not going to accomplish as much as the people who put in a little bit of work every single day towards all of their goals, including changing the world, which is a big task. And it is amazing how much you can accomplish just by putting a little bit of effort in on some task every single day. It certainly works with things like learning languages, studying mathematics, things like that are cumulative that you just can't put off to the end and then cram it all in and really accomplish much. And it's the same with revolution. It's the same with social change. If you put in a lot of work over a long period of time, and it's good work, it's actually productive, you can accomplish a great, great deal, and you still have time to lead the rest of your life and to be an all-around excellent person. And I really think it makes our movement much more attractive if that is one of our leading messages, that we want you to be all-around excellent people. And if you're not all-around excellent people, we're going to chide you a little and encourage you to improve yourselves and become a better person. And that also guards against one of the things that you mentioned earlier, which is that there are a lot of bad people who get involved in this kind of marginal radical politics. And we'd like to improve the overall average quality of these people. Generally, what I've said, and I think it's true, is that among the worst people I've ever met are movement people, but the best people I've ever met are also movement people. And it would be nice just to sort set in motion a selection process that makes the good people a larger and larger percentage and the bad people a smaller and smaller one, either because they become better people or they just feel like maybe their lives would be better spent doing something else.
Yeah, extremely, extremely well said. I agree completely. I think that nails it. I was going to reference something I think that Jordan Peterson talks about that kind of parallels what you were just saying. And I'll admit I've been on kind of a Jordan Peterson tear lately. And I know not everyone who shares our views is a big fan of him, but I don't agree with him on everything. But he is a very wise dude, and it's hard not to be influenced by his thinking, given that he's kind of everywhere. But he, you know, it's like what he says about not trying to change the world until you can make your bed. And I think that usually when we hear that, we're thinking about the left and all the social justice warriors, because most of the people out there protesting everything and trying, you know, to radically change the world are these blue-haired, nose ring wearing, you know, liberal college students who, you know, haven't done anything in their life and are kind of a perfect example of that. But I think it's something for all of us on the right to be cognizant of as well, is that, you know, any positive change that we want to make has to be an outgrowth of positive changes in our own life. And like with me, I mean, I try to be more cognizant now that, I mean, there's lots of areas I don't know the answers to. And I've been trying to be better about not trying to prescribe solutions on things that I really haven't studied in depth. And there are some things that I feel really passionate about and that I have studied in depth. And, you know, I'm going to go out there and advance my narrative to try to, and our narrative to try to counteract the narrative on the other side, obviously. But I think it's very important to always be humble and to, you know, realize we're all flawed and none of us know everything. And then, yeah, the other side of that what you were saying just made me think of too, is kind of what I was saying about there being so many different paths. And I had an interesting experience, and I write about it in the new book, but it kind of follows from what we're talking about. But I got the chance to go to a local kind of, you know, normal establishment conservative meeting. There was this really famous worldwide conservative figure speaking at it. And me and about 15 other guys who share our views, the four of us, about 15 of us got to go to it and sit at a VIP table where I think it must have been like $1,000 seats or something. And it was basically all possible because a young millennial guy who had made lots and lots of money through, I can't remember what it was. It was like cryptocurrency or real estate, some kind of entrepreneurial endeavor. But, you know, he was like 29 years old, I think, and he had made a lot of money by basically starting a business and growing it and getting really wealthy. And he was now basically reinvesting large amounts of money into our movement, into trying to fight for the future of Western civilization. So we all got to go to this, and you know, we kind of had a solid plan going in of, you know, what we were hoping to accomplish and kind of build relationships with these sort of establishment Republicans. But I remember sitting there during it, and like I said, there were about 1,000 people here at, you know, at the thing, and they had all, you know, spent varying amounts, but you know, pretty high amounts of money to get seats there. They were all people who are, you know, influential in the, I guess, conservative movement in America, in this, you know, the area that I live in. And I remember looking out at the whole crowd, and about, you know, 80-90% of them were all baby boomers, you know, people between about 55 and 80 years old or so. And I was thinking, you know, man, in 25, 30 years, none of these people are going to be here, and it's going to be all of us millennials. And, you know, I looked around the table, and there's 15 other guys who share my thinking, our thinking on all this stuff. And then basically every other millennial I had met there too. I mean, there weren't that many, but I, you know, I kind of spoke with maybe another like 10 or 20 who I met there. And they all had views that seemed way more congruent with ours than the sort of mainstream Rush Limbaugh conservatism. And it was a very inspiring, hopeful experience, because it showed that just the passage of time on its own is going to really allow for a lot of change. And if enough young people do embrace our views, and if we build enough sort of social capital, whether that's wealth or connections or influence or whatever else it is, that there really is a lot that's possible to be done.
Well, that's, you know, what I said before, I think is so very important, is that we don't want people to drift away from this before we get to that point. And I think that is a real risk. I think that you're right, that if we attach this sort of activism to other things, maybe that won't happen. But it's very important to try to keep people, you know, on this path, I think. Because, I mean, look back to, I mean, the boomers, a lot of the people who are, you know, the boomers of the Republican and the Democrat Party now, probably back in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of them were communists or, you know, anarchists or whatever. And then they gradually shifted into, you know, the mainstream of political life in America. But we don't want that to happen with our people. I mean, we don't want people who are extreme in the sense that, you know, they believe things that ordinary Americans can't identify with or whatever. But we want it to remain, you know, radical, quote unquote, in the sense that, you know, we think that, that race and ethnicity do matter. You know, we do think that America, was created by people of European descent for people of European descent primarily. I think it's going to be tricky, but that's the thing, is we have to keep people from getting absorbed into the mainstream narratives of American society, which are still very strong.
Yeah, we need to bring the mainstream in our direction. And I think that that's what's happening. I think the Overton window is shifting in our direction. And it's a good thing. It's a positive change. One thing that I learned in 2001 when I went to the Front National's big rally in Paris was the importance of a community that is larger than just a political party, and a community that has a rhythm and a life to it that's not just tied to the political campaign cycle. That, I think, is what really sustains people's involvement. And there's kind of a tendency in America to get caught up in campaigns, political campaigns. I'm sure it's true in France as well. You get caught up in the campaigns, you put a lot of energy into it, you put a lot of hope into it, and then of course you're disappointed. Usually we're disappointed, even though we are moving forward. It's easy to get really blackpilled if the thing that sustains your involvement is measured in terms of success at the polls. And so there have to be other things that we're involved in that we can succeed at and draw sustenance from spiritually, during the non-campaign seasons and even during the campaign seasons, because otherwise there's just not enough there to sustain people's involvement. And people do have to feel some kind of personal rewards from their involvement with this movement. If there are no personal rewards, the only thing that we can appeal to is idealism. And, you know, at a certain point, if you just keep going back to people and saying, we need you to sacrifice more, we need you to sacrifice more, they're going to say, I'm sorry, I'm all tapped out. I just don't have anything left in me to keep doing this. I need to get something out of this personally. And what you get out of it has to be some kind of sense that you are accomplishing something, that not just that you're doing the right thing, that's very important, but that you feel sustained by the community. The interactions you have. You've got to have positive interactions with a lot of people. And I think that we're learning that. And one of the things that's been exciting in the past few years is seeing little community organizations and networks popping up of red-pilled people. And some of these, you know, have ups and downs. Some of them collapse. Some of them fragment and so forth. That's all normal. And I think we just need to keep experimenting to see what works. But I do think that as an overall strategy, creating a racially aware community that does other stuff than just politics is really a key thing. And I think the French
Yes.
did that really, really well. I think, you know, in Hungary, they do that really, really well. I mean, Hungary itself is sort of a giant racially aware community. It's a very patriotic place. The same is true with Poland. And it would be nice to have little microcosms of that in paused, rootless America. So there are things moving in that direction. And just, Julian, you mentioning this group getting together and doing that. I mean, I imagine you guys do other stuff besides going to political fundraisers.
Yeah, and I can't take credit for that. I'll be honest. I've only hung out with all these guys on maybe two or three occasions, but they all do an immense job of being very deliberate about getting together, you know, even if it's not ideal for them schedule wise or, you know, in other ways. So I'm not an expert on the little local group by any means. And like I said, I've only met with them a couple times. I wish I should do more and get more involved. That's an area I could do better in. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it does seem to be exactly what you're talking about. And I think that another good point that made me think of is, is sort of on the importance of the journey rather than just the destination. Because, I mean, obviously, I think there's a understandable tendency with what we're all focused on to very much focus on the destination or on the end outcome, because the end outcome could either be some really horrible scenarios, you know, like South Africa, Brazil, et cetera, or they could be good ones. So, I mean, obviously, we're going to have a tendency to just focus on all of this stuff based on, you know, thinking about what the end result will be the long term. However, I think that to really make it sustainable and enjoyable and kind of community based, like you're talking about, it's helpful for us all to think about it in sort of a journey way, that we're not just only doing this in order to achieve the outcome we all want at the end. We're also doing it because it's the right thing to do. Even if we end up, you know, failing at the end and Western Europe is completely destroyed, or, you know, all the worst case scenarios happen, it's still something we should be doing just because it's inherently the right thing to do, because to not do it would be to, you know, intensely dishonor our ancestors and all of their sacrifices to allow us to be here, not to mention our descendants or lack thereof, depending on how things take place. So I think that, you know, like anything in life, focusing on the day-to-day journey aspects of it rather than on the just hypothetical end result is a way to make it much more sustainable. And then I agree, I think the more that the politics become embedded within or connected within or overlapping other, you know, non-political stuff, whether it's cultural or whatever it is, I think is a really positive thing. And actually, I've been on Gab for the last 2 weeks. I've never been a big social media person my whole life. I've always kind of disliked it. But since I started the new YouTube channel, I've hopped on Twitter and Gab in the last couple of weeks. And I've been really impressed on Gab really surprised that if you look at the trending topics, half the time the top trending topics are people talking about like painting and architecture or their pets and all this stuff. And I think it's a good example of what you were just talking about, in that it's sort of more than just the politics. It's this kind of community of people. And obviously that's still online, of course. But I think it's a good example of what you were saying. And I think that all of that and everything we're doing is starting to attract more and more people who, you know, you might consider more of the mainstream Republicans, like a lot of the people I kind of grew up around in these rural areas, you know, who hunted and fished their whole life and, you know, were huge, huge Second Amendment fans. And I think for most of the last 10 years or so, 5 years, that's been a very kind of distinct political subculture from us. But I think that increasingly, as pretty much everyone, even remotely on the right, is demonized by the left and attacked by the left, like the NRA and the Second Amendment fans are suffering through right now, I think it coalesces all of us together way more, and we become far less fractioned and more of a united force, which is positive.
Yeah, so you mentioned the YouTube channel. So let's talk about that channel. What are some of the things you're trying to accomplish with it? What are some of the topics you're dealing with and so forth?
Sure, yeah. So I created it about 3 weeks ago, and it was something I had thought about for quite a while. I mean, I'd been thinking about whether or not to create a YouTube channel for the last year, and I didn't want to do it unless I was going to go 110% into it, you know, applying massive daily action and focus to it. But I ultimately decided I wanted to do it. And I took it very seriously. The preparation, I probably spent about $1,500 on different software programs and, you know, different forms of preparation, everything like that, you know, recorded 15 videos before I even launched the channel. And it's been live for about 3 weeks, and it's going really well. I mean, it's still not many subscribers, so anyone who listens to this can go and subscribe. It's called Conquering Modernity. But I have very, very big plans for it, and certainly intend on putting a massive action into it and hopefully growing it up really big and hopefully doing a lot of good with it. And I'd say the focus is pretty much kind of what I was describing earlier, which is sort of the meeting point of self-improvement and identitarianism, or preservationism, as I like to call it. And so some of the videos are, you know, more political in nature. Like I have a video about what's going on in Sweden and everything like that. And I imagine I'll end up making lots of videos about what's going on in Sweden, because there's no shortage of relevant news out of Sweden these days. But then there's other videos that are more sort of self-improvement based, you know, or even kind of entrepreneurial. So it's sort of right on that line. I'd say in terms of content, I'd say it's probably most similar to the Golden one in terms of the focuses. in terms of kind of like, you know, masculinity, self-improvement, weightlifting, politics, identitarianism, the situation in Europe. But then in terms of style, I'd say I'm probably trying to mimic Paul Joseph Watson's style a little bit more, a little bit of kind of Black Pigeon Speaks, but trying to do a lot of editing, jump cuts, make it, you know, very, very watchable. Because the YouTube algorithm is primarily based on average view duration. So the longer that an average viewer stays on a particular video, the more that they're going to suggest it in the suggested videos feed and everything like that. So that and, you know, trying to have good thumbnails. Basically, their algorithm's based on average view duration per 1,000 impressions. So I'm trying to make them very, you know, quick, fast-paced, very watchable videos, you know, with background music, everything like that, and trying to create really good thumbnails. And, yeah, the goal of it is to hopefully put massive amounts of work into it and awaken as many people as possible to the threats that our people are facing. And then also hopefully provide, I guess, a positive lens of viewing that, a positive course where it's not just focused on black pills and, oh, how horrible everything is, but also focused on how best to respond. I guess if that's how I was going to describe it, I'd say the focus is on how best to respond to modernity or the current year as a Western, you know, Occidental male in the West today.
Yeah, that's very inspiring. I'm very encouraged. I've watched two of the videos. I thought they were really quite well done. We will start sharing some of these things at Countercurrents and on our Facebook pages and things like that. And I hope it'll grow. I hope it'll be a positive thing for you and for the world. It is a very powerful medium. There's no question about it. I have friends now who used to watch television. They don't watch TV anymore. They watch YouTube if they want to relax before they go to bed. They simply have left network television behind. One of my slogans that I've used for years, because I'm not a network TV person and I don't listen to the radio, I program myself. That's the term that I use. Program yourself. You choose your own programming. And I don't just mean that in the sense of TV programs and radio programs. I mean programming your mind, because if you don't program yourself, they're going to program you with a lot of nonsense and a lot of propaganda. And so take control of your life. Program yourself. Choose your own TV. Choose your own music. And choose your own way of thinking.
I agree. And I'm more of a writing guy, to be honest. Like you know, if it was only what I enjoy doing most, I'd probably just write all day long and I wouldn't have created a YouTube channel. Although I am really, really enjoying it and the process of creating the videos. It is really fulfilling. But I really love the written word and I love to read and write and everything like that. But as I started to do more and more things online and kind of learned all the research more and more and started to focus on it for more of a business or economical perspective or just learning about that stuff, I realized that among lots of people today, and especially the younger generation, consumption of the written word is unfortunately just dropping precipitously, and consumption of YouTube videos is rising dramatically. So I think that we are going to be entering a period over the next 5 years where video is just going to make up a bigger and bigger percentage of the internet. And, you know, that is what it is. It's not necessarily good or bad. It's just, you know, an evolution of the technology and how people consume different things. But I do think that compared to the old network television days before the internet, the rise of streaming videos and people creating their own YouTube channels is an enormously positive thing. Like, if I think about all the different channels I've kind of gone through phases of binge watching, I mean, I've learned, you know, immense amounts of things from YouTube that I probably never could have learned otherwise. But just like anything, I mean, there's some channels on YouTube that are amazing and have unbelievably valuable content. And then there's a whole ton of channels that have kind of mindless content and some that have really toxic content. So it's just going to be a reflection of the broader society, basically.
So one thing that interests me as a person who's creating content is the daily routines of creative people. I've actually been reading a book about this. I've been trying to retrench, refocus, take stock of my life and my work right now. And just looking ahead, thinking, how many more productive years do I have and how can I maximize these? And so I've been very, very concerned with figuring out the best way of going forward. So you are a high energy person. You are a very productive person. You're juggling a lot of stuff. What is your typical work day like? Because I think people who are pondering getting into this, they have to think about this and they have to have some models to go by. V.S. Pritchett in an essay on Gibbon, the historian, has this line, these sentences that haunt me. He said, "In the end, all great men are the same. They work all the time. They never lose a minute." And he says that's a depressing lesson, that in the end, everybody who accomplishes a lot is basically the same. They work really, really hard. And I think we have to wrap our minds around that. It's not through sudden flights of inspiration or, you know, all-nighters and stuff like that, that the world has changed. And even the artists that you think are most dependent on inspiration, it turns out that they had incredibly regular work habits. It's just interesting to me now that I've become attuned to this issue to ask everybody I know, okay, so how do you do it? How do you juggle wife, kids, job, and then writing and producing YouTube videos? What's your typical day like? And lifting weights.
Sure. Well, hopefully this won't bore anyone, but I do think it's a fantastic question. And I guess mine's probably a little different. I imagine in your case, you probably spend a lot of time editing and doing stuff like that because that's a big part of what you do. But for me right now, and I guess another caveat is I won't get too much into my personal situation, but for right now, I'm able to focus 100% of my time on writing and content creation rather than some of my other, business interests. But right now I wake up and, get ready, kind of hang out with my 5-year-old and my wife for a little bit while I get ready in the morning. And then I come to the office I rent. And, I've been doing intermittent fasting where I don't eat until about 2 p.m. in the afternoon, which I like from a health perspective, but I also like because it allows me, I used to eat like 5 times a day. I'm kind of a relatively big guy. So I used to spend a lot of time eating. So eating twice a day is much better for productivity. So I come here. I do my
Younger agrees with you.
Oh, good. Yeah, I never thought I could get into it, but I love it.
He used to say he would skip lunch because he said it would suck all his creative energy out if he ate lunch. So he would just eat something in the morning and then just go until evening and then eat again. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted you.
That's a great point. I agree. Yeah, I eat about 2,200 calories at 1 or 2 p.m. every day and then another 2,200 calories around 9 or 10 p.m. So that's my, focus in that. And then basically when I get to the office, first I kind of do my morning routine. I kind of do this, probably sounds unbelievably hokey and stupid to people, but my kind of, affirmations, visualizations, just kind of writing things down that I want to focus on, just reminding yourself that, every single day you could get in a car wreck and die. Just the kind of things that keep you deliberate and purposeful and, not too kind of wrapped up in your lizard brain, so to speak, but that give you the perspective you need. And then from there, I pretty much begin kind of producing content, writing, or doing YouTube videos. And I don't have a really set schedule for those. I'm very focused on organization. I use Evernote to kind of organize everything. I have it on my phone and my computer. So I have like an ongoing map of my, YouTube videos I'm going to do and everything I'm writing and my to-do lists. I try to, look at the to-do list at least, once a day and I redo it once a week. I write down all the different tasks I need to get done. And then I also do kind of like a daily tracking where I track, what kind of weightlifting I do, anything that I want to be focused on and do well at. I just track it every day on Evernote, basically. And that tracking, it just kind of, I think, forces your mind or even your subconscious to do better at those things, kind of like tracking calories. So I track calories too. And even though I eat the exact same food every day, writing it all down in the little MyFitnessPal app every day, I think is just healthy because it keeps me deliberate and purposeful, basically. But yeah, and then mostly I just create content all day around 1 p.m. I lift weights for maybe like 20 minutes, not a really long time. And then I eat my first meal and then I get back to content creation and pretty much just work all day. And then later in the evening, I'll eat again. I usually do a few push-ups first or just air squats or something. And then after I eat, I'll work a little bit more. And then at about 9 or 10 p.m., I'll go back to my house and see my wife and my kid. My wife's a stay-at-home mom. And see them, and then I take every Sunday off completely, and I don't do any content creation at all or any work. And then usually once a week on Thursday, I'll kind of work from home and take half the day off.
That's great. That's really, really useful. I'm going to try and encourage more people who are involved in this movement to think about this kind of stuff and to talk about it and just have a conversation so we can all think about improving our productivity, finding the routines that are right for us. Personally, I've noticed that social media has become recently more of a bane than a boon in my life. It really has the capacity to mince up my attention into tiny little sound bites and info bites and things like that. And it has, I think, been a detraction. However, Facebook is indispensable for running my business. Maybe I shouldn't be putting that out there because they'll start trying to ban me. But I've had a couple of Facebook bans, and what I've done is I've upped my privacy levels, and I purged hundreds or actually thousands of people who were friends on there just because, well, I didn't even know who these people were, just to try and get rid of the rats. And I need to keep that thing functioning just so I can stay in touch with a lot of my collaborators and content producers and so forth. A lot of my work is facilitated by social media. I can't do without it, but it really is necessary for me to ride it more carefully, because if you are kind of lax in your usage patterns, these things are designed to be addictive and they're designed to waste your time. And, you know, if you're not conscious of that fact and if you're not fighting against that, that is exactly what it'll do to you. So I've been more focused on keeping away from social media during set times of the day, setting aside 3-hour chunks of the day when I don't have any contact with social media, either through my desktop, my laptop, or my smartphone, just going in a room, closing the door, and sitting on a bed or at a desk and writing with pen and paper. And it's really increased my productivity a lot. And I think that that's something that I'm going to be more attentive to in the future. I thought that I could just sort of do everything, juggle everything, let it all sort of swim around at the same time. And it really had slowly, subtly, stealthily stolen away a lot of my productivity. So I'm trying to get on top of that. And I'm trying to get as much information from other people about these sorts of things, and I'm hoping that others will start thinking more deliberately about that as well.
I agree. Like I said, I've only been doing Twitter and Gab for about the last 3 weeks since I started the YouTube channel, but I can definitely see how that could become the case very easily. And with those two things, I've tried to basically just sign in only twice a day and just furiously do as many posts and tweets as I can, because they're immensely powerful things. I mean, it's really incredible just what you can accomplish now with social media if you build a following, whether that's in the political sphere or the business sphere or anything mm-hmm. else. So I finally embraced the fact that if I wanted to do all this stuff, I had to do social media. I don't have Facebook yet. I'll admit there's something about the Facebook interface that just looking at it, and I've never done Facebook, but you know, I've been around it because it's so omnipresent in society, but there's something about it that just fills me with anxiety. I don't know what it is, but I don't know if I'll ever be able to convince myself to do Facebook, but I am enjoying Gab and Twitter, and they are immensely powerful platforms. And then I'll probably try a few other kinds of social media. But I think that to build on what you were just saying, or what you said a little while ago too, as far as, you know, we only have so much time. One thing I'm trying to do better at myself as well is to focus on putting really evergreen content out there. Like I'm trying to think about, okay, am I writing about something where this could, you know, maybe provide value for people for a few days because it's kind of newsworthy? Or am I creating a video that, you know, hopefully people could still derive value from 3 years from now? So I'm trying to do the latter just because, you know, we have so little time on this earth, and it takes so much time to produce good content that I'm trying to make it things that'll always be valuable, or that I could, you know, if it's an essay, have it be an essay that I could later on put into a book that I'm going to write, or, you know, a book full of essays that I might publish, and just focus on that kind of evergreen content versus getting caught up in things that are big right now, but not as valuable long term for people.
Well, I do want to say, just because earlier in the conversation you referenced the fact that you thought reading was dropping off for younger people and that videos and social media were becoming more important. That's definitely true, but, you know, I've read some of your stuff, and you're a very good writer, so I hope you will keep doing that alongside your other projects, because, you know, I know from some of your essays that you love literature and writing as well, as do I. But even beyond that, I still do believe there are certain things you can only do with writing that you can't do as well in social media and with videos. So I hope you'll keep doing that as in addition to everything else.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for the kind words. I appreciate that. And I definitely will. I could never stop writing, and I absolutely love the process of outlining and writing a book. So I definitely think I'll, unless everybody completely quits reading books, which I don't think will happen. I think we'll always have lots of readers out there. I definitely plan on continuing to write books for us as long as I'm alive, certainly.
Have any of your normie friends or colleagues discovered your writings and asked you about your support of identitarianism and over the past few years?
A little bit. The only time I've ever really had a bad experience with it is if like a really radical social justice warrior type that kind of tangentially knows me. I've had a couple of them, you know, say negative things, but that's about it. I mean, I think that I'm a pretty darn normal guy, and I think most of the things that I put online are pretty stinking commonsensical, and I'm trying to be deliberate about that now. I mean, I think, you know, because there's different ways of going about it, and I don't think that's a better route to take at all. I think if I was different or my situation was different, it might be way more valuable for me to be really purposefully provocative and kind of fulfill that role of being outside the Overton window, pulling it towards you from outside. But I think that because I'm a pretty average guy, and you know, I'm kind of the normie Chad type to some degree, I think that I feel like the best way I can contribute is sort of accentuating the fact that I'm a pretty normal average dude, and accentuating the fact that these views that we have are, in my opinion, about as commonsensical and normal as anything could be. I mean, you know, the idea that Sweden should replace its population with Muslims is the radical, insane idea. The idea that Sweden should stay Swedish is about as commonsensical as anything could be. So I think that most people I know, if they read what I write online, they'd probably agree with it. When you really talk to other people in our society, I think unless they're like a radical leftist, if you talk to most people and you can actually have a real conversation with them, I think that they pretty much agree with a lot of the things we talk about. I think more than anything, a lot of it kind of comes down to presentation. And obviously we can't always control that, because other people can write about us and take what we say out of context and mischaracterize what it is we're saying and that what we believe and everything like that. And I'm sure that'll happen to me just like it happens to everyone. But as far as what I actually write, I think that most of the people I know, you know, whether online or in real life, probably wouldn't disagree with it too much at all.
You know, that's great. I think you've managed, by being more mainstream, you've avoided some of the ostracism and pigeonholing treatment that people who have been in this longer and more openly have received from the SPLC and so on and so forth. And that's really important as far as getting the message out there to a broader audience.
Yeah, well, like I said, I think both are important. I mean, I wouldn't even remotely advance the idea that you know, that route that I'm kind of going is a better one. And certainly it's also easier too. So I have immense respect for the people, you know, that really kind of put their head on the chopping block and put themselves out there and say those provocative things that do have utility. I mean, provocation can be pointless at times. I mean, I think we could all think of examples of people that, you know, roughly share our views, who say some really provocative things, you know, only out of frustration or the desire to be provocative, where maybe those things don't end up being helpful. But there's other times where, you know, provocation can really be helpful and have a lot of utility. So, and, you know, I certainly do think there are, you know, a lot of things I'd say that are, you know, somewhat provocative compared to mainstream stuff. But I guess it just comes down to being deliberate about all that and just trying to figure out what it is you're trying to accomplish through the different things you write or say.
Well, this has been a really good conversation. We are topping an hour now, so I think we should probably wrap up. So, Julian, let's wrap up by just having you plug your website, your book, and your YouTube channel, and let's hope that there is a rush of new people who are checking out your work.
Sure, yeah. Well, let's see. So the new book is on Amazon. It went live today in ebook form. I still got to get the print version live on there. And it's titled Identity Rising, How Nationalist Millennials Will Retake Europe, Save America, and Become the New Greatest Generation. And then my website that I've been posting things to the last couple of years is EuropeanCivilWar.com. And that's pretty much just focused on, you know, stories relevant to what's going on in Europe and discussing what's going on in Europe, everything like that. And then the new YouTube channel is I still am publishing lots of stuff to the website, so definitely check that out, too. But the new YouTube channel is called Conquering Modernity. And that's probably where I'm putting the vast majority of my focus now. and just building it up, trying to put out lots of good videos, and growth on YouTube is exponential. So it's always a little slow at first, and then it picks up. So yeah, just posting lots of good content and seeing the subscriber count grow, and I encourage everyone to check that out and subscribe.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a great conversation, and I know this is just going to be the first of many. So we'll have you back very soon, I hope.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you a ton for the opportunity. It's been great talking with you guys.